The IMG Roadmap is the only podcast dedicated to coaching international medical graduates and success blueprints for this unique pathway. I am Dr. Nina Loom, your host, a previous IMG turned hospital medicine physician, healthcare administrator, speaker, and coach. I empower, encourage, and equip you with actionable steps that you can take towards the residency position of your dreams.
Hi, guys. Welcome to another episode of the IMG Roma podcast. Today's guest is special, as always, but I would like to introduce you guys to Dr. Sapoma. She's a family medicine physician as well, and I really want her to go ahead and tell us about herself. Welcome on the show, Dr. Sapoma.
Thank you so much for having me. This has just been such a pleasure just to kind of sit down and reflect on this path that I've had. So I really thank you for that.
Thanks for coming on. We appreciate it. So can you tell us a little bit about yourself, like where you went to medical school, where you practice, you know, are you a U.S. IMG, a non-U.S. IMG, those types of details?
Yeah, perfect. So the first thing I want to say, and might come to some surprise and hopefully not too much of a surprise to people, but actually for me, becoming an international medical graduate as a U.S. born citizen, for me, that was my first choice. Like that's what actually I really wanted to do. I was born in the United States. Both my parents are from Ghana, Africa. I grew up in California. My parents were very loving, but very strict. I have, you know, African parents can be very, very, very interesting. So I kind of, from a child, I knew I wanted to be a doctor, but that was really ingrained in me. But I did the arts, I sang and I danced, and I actually did a partial scholarship to UCLA. So I went to UCLA, and when I was at UCLA, I did pre-med, but I also did international development studies. And so with that, you could study like everything that has to do with international development. And that includes the culture, the health, and the arts, and the politics and economics of that. And it was through that I was able to study abroad. And so with that, I studied to Latin America, and I traveled there. And I also traveled to my home country of Ghana, West Africa. And so it was actually through there that I met Cuban doctors, and over there, the Cuban doctors, they provide excellent care in all the different types of health settings, and they were actually speaking the languages, my personal language that I'm actually not even that well speaking at, but they actually speak it, and I found out about the medical program in Cuba. So it was really through that I decided I wanted to just study medicine in Cuba. And everybody looked at me crazy, like, you know, you're already in the United States. At that time, the United States did not have that much of a great relationship with Cuba because of the embargo. But there was a new scholarship that was actually open for U.S. students. It was a really small group of U.S. students that they were only accepting 10 at the time. And so I applied. I did apply to the U.S. school just to appease my parents because I knew I wouldn't hear the end of it if I did not. So I really simultaneously, I did the MCAT, applied through MCAT to the U.S. programs, and then I also applied to the Cuba programs, but the Cuba program accepted me first, and they accepted me first with a scholarship. So at that point, I went and I told my parents, said, hey, I have a full scholarship to medical school, so I don't think we can really beat that. And so the rest is history. That's pretty much what I did. I went in the early parts of 2000. It was a six-year program, all in Spanish. And I actually did it in 7 years because I actually ended up having a child while I was in medical school. So that's the short, long story of it.
Right. That's amazing. That's actually amazing. Because yeah. I only know one other lady who's just starting out residency. She's going to start this summer. And she went to medical school in Cuba as well. And it's actually interesting to listen to her story. She's also an American and did that process. And so, you know, it's one of the countries that I guess from my neck of the woods and with the IMGs that listen to the podcast, we probably don't have a whole lot of people that have, you know, that know or have been there, but we do get a lot of other IMGs from Central American countries or South American countries that can relate, you know. So I know your story is also going to be pertinent either way. Because I think once an IMG, everything just ties in. You know, it's sort of very similar pathway, similar struggles.
Absolutely.
So I'll get some more questions for you. So do you remember, you know, can you walk us through some of your pathway into residency training? Did going to Cuba, did it place, you know, did it cause any more challenges than maybe the U.S. system would have if you had stayed?
Yeah, I think that's a very good question. So first off, the training is all in Spanish, and that was something that for me, it was really important to have the Spanish background because I knew I was going to return to California, and the majority of the places that I wanted to practice were Spanish speaking. So I really wanted to have that. The downside, though, of that was that all of our classes, like I said, are in Spanish. So I had to, at the end of the day, kind of when it was time to review for my steps, I had to kind of really get back to the basics with English. And so it sounds funny, but I mean, I remember opening the first aid for the USMLE. And I was kind of relieved because I was like, oh my gosh, this is, if I would have thought about it, English is so much easier. But at the same time, it was hard because I had to kind of use a different part of my brain. The other thing is that the way that tests are taken in Cuba, very different. They're verbal, they're oral, and they don't do standardized exams, and they don't do kind of shelf exams. So they're really big on really getting that training and the clinical practice. So like my first year, I was, you know, doing, assisting in surgeries, you know, delivering babies in my, you know, the first year of my of classes. In the U.S., I know it's a little bit different. I know you can have those experiences, but they're not really top heavy with basic sciences. In Cuba, it's not like you're going to do basic sciences and then you're going to do clinical. Everything is woven together. So that was a little bit of a downside when it came to really trying to train for the USMLE, where everything was for step one was just, I mean, step one is a different language. And so I really had to kind of buckle down for that. The other thing that I will say, graduating from the program, so the CUBA program is really not a program for those that are kind of looking for what we used to call back in the day a fifth pathway, or a pathway to kind of where you do your first couple of years in on the island and then you do your last years in the United States. All the training is done in conjunction with the Ministry of Health in that country. So you're really catered to international global health within Cuba and then within the world. And so you're not really trained or geared to do stuff in the United States. In saying that, really understanding the U.S. healthcare system, it's not hard, but it's just something that you really do have to learn. We did not have pharmaceutical companies. We did not have billing. It's a universal healthcare system. So there was no understanding of prior authorizations. You know, there was no electronic medical records. So those types of things I had to learn all on my own. The other thing was when I graduated from the CUBA program, me, myself, I actually graduated as a single mother with a two-year-old, and I had not taken any exams. And that's something that is really now in my program is really odd because most people are taking the USMLEs after their second, third, and fourth year. So I literally had to cram step one, step two, step two CS in a year. And it actually took me a year and a half because I had to take step one all over again because I didn't realize that when I left the United States, I was also leaving a lot of the anxiety. I had a lot of test anxiety, a lot of standardized exam anxiety. And so when I returned, it kind of all came back. It was really weird. So I had to start all over. I had to do like visualization techniques. I had to, you know, start with meditation. I mean, so it was a lot of stuff. But I'll say for all of you guys that have had to take the steps over again, or you know, you're not doing so well in your USMLE worlds or MBMEs, that really look into see what's going on. Is it the content, or are you anxious about the answering the questions? Are you second guessing yourself? These were things that were dormant in me, and I had to really look through and find out. But after that, I was able to do that, and I was able to pass, and I was able to match into the residency program that I like.
That's really great. Actually, when you're talking, I just remembered one of the a certain Dr. Tia, she had actually reached out to me a few months ago and took one of my courses for IMGs regarding how to prepare yourself to make yourself a competitive applicant. And I'm just thinking about questions that Tia would have for you, because you're probably the person that she would want to talk to as far as someone that went to school in Cuba that knows exactly where she's coming from. I know she'll have questions regarding, you know, observerships. How did you get U.S. clinical experience? Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
So I always tell the IMGs, especially because I sit at the medical advisory committee for my medical school. So I'm working closely with the students. And I always talk with them about the summers, like really take advantage of the fact that a lot of these schools that are not in the United States, they really do have a month or a 2 month summer. A lot of people will go home and they will maybe, you know, spend time with family, rent, party, all of the above. But I say, you can do that, but you should also try to really carve out some time to make the acquaintance with a faculty and attending, somebody that is linked to your medical school. Because all these medical schools that are all over the world, there are attendings that are connected to attendings in the United States. And some of them are really connected in a way that is very informal, which is perfect. Because if they're friends, like for instance, one of my attendings in biochemistry, she was a very good friend with a pediatrician that went to Harvard or that was teaching at Harvard and you know, so things like that. And so sometimes those are just ways that you can talk to somebody and then get an observership. And sometimes the observerships are not going to be at a big academic center. Sometimes you're going to be able just to go to the private clinic of one of the attendings or the free clinic of another attending, or maybe you do know a doctor in the family or a friend of the family. I say any type of setting that you can get, I really do recommend that you try it out. There are some schools like my school, the Cuba school, that they don't have a formal observership or clinical clerkship that they have with U.S. schools, but it's fine because it is understood that this is a Ministry of Health school, and Ministry of Health schools, especially in the Caribbean and all over Africa, they have to abide by the standards of that country. So that's usually a given. And even I used to sit on, all of us that were in residency, you know, had a little bit to do with the application process when we matched. And that was something that we understood, that those students that apply from other countries, that some of them were not going to have that observership or clerkship that is linked on to a U.S. school. But as long as you try to, and as long as you really seek it out, you're going to be able to have some success in that.
Yeah, I definitely agree. So with your education, did you end up having any gaps, like from when you finished your curriculum in Cuba and between that time and when you started your residency training here?
Yes. So I had a pretty chunk of a gap. I had at least 2.5 years because, like I said, I graduated in 2009. And when I graduated, I had no steps under me. I had no USMLEs. All I had was my daughter in my hand and that was it. And so the biggest thing for me was I had my MD, and that was powerful, and that was something that I could use, and I was bilingual. So what I did was I gave myself like 6 months, because I graduated in June or July, and so I gave myself, you know, a couple months just to be with family, because the reality is, like, after you graduate, and especially if you're in that situation, it's just realistically you're not going to get that much studying done. So I told myself, okay, I'm going to give myself a couple months just to kind of see the family, see everything, and kind of really hang out with friends. And I told myself January 1st, I was going to really get everything out. And so what I did was I really relied on a study plan and a study schedule. I don't know if anybody can pass this exam or do it without a study plan. And so I couldn't do a live course. So I had to do the live courses that were already recorded. So everything for me, I know now people are doing virtual courses now that are live because of the pandemic. That was my reality. And I talked to a lot of other single moms during that time. That was their reality as well. So I did a lot of that. And then, so I had about a year gap in between the time I graduated and the time I started residency. And that also has to do with the ECFMG laws, which for my school, we got our degree after. And so especially if you had not taken any exams, you were not ECFMG certified by the time you graduated. And even if you did take ECFMG exams, you could not apply in your fifth year or during your sixth year. You had to at least graduate and then you get your ECFMG certification. So that was another issue with my program, but it was still worth it because it was a scholarship. So talking about my gap, with that, after I studied for step one and I passed it finally, then I started to do stuff with nonprofit organizations. I really tried to get my stuff to do some medical, clinical and non-clinical things. I was a translator. I worked as a caregiver in a nursing home. So I was really just trying to get my feet wet and make sure that I was still within the medical system, even if it wasn't direct patient care. And so that was what I did until I was able to enter the match in 2012. And as we know, the match is a whole year process that you have to apply. You have to go in with ERAS and then with interviews. It's a very long process. And so that was, I think by that time in 2012 when I applied, I was very mature. And I think every interview I went on, I understood the process, and even the residency program and the hospital administration, I understood the different levels that it took to kind of run a program and run a hospital. So I think they were, you know, really kind of proud of that. So I always say, if there's a gap, what are you going to do with that gap? You know, are you going to, you know, just kind of be upset and, you know, really not motivated and think, oh, all my friends are in residency? Or what are you going to do? You can now, you know, there's so much stuff on YouTube. There's so much stuff online. You can learn so much about the hospital system, and you can even be a part of that hospital system too as well. And that'll just make you even a stronger and a better applicant when you apply to residency.
Yeah, definitely. I agree with you. A lot of the extracurricular work that IMGs can do really put us in a position that, you know, it helps with sort of what I call beef up our CV. You know, it makes time account, the time that we feel could be wasted, we're actually putting an account to it. So another question is, so how did you eventually, you know, match into residency? Can you tell us your story, how many interviews you got after doing all that work and putting in that extra time with your several medically relevant activities that you did?
So let me tell you, I made sure, because I was the non-traditional student and I also had a kid, to be at a place where I could get help. If it wasn't going to be near family, it was a place where if I had to send my daughter to be with my family, I could easily jump on a plane and go and visit her and vice versa. So that for me was number one. So pretty much a year prior to me to applying, after I was able to successfully pass step one and successfully pass the rest of the exams, I made sure to go to my specialties conferences in the states that I wanted to do residency. So for me, it was family medicine. So family medicine, they put on a lot of things, a lot of conferences yearly. So I went to the California Family Medicine Conference, and I just made sure I interacted with all the residents. I got to know people, and I even went to, the key thing is just not going during the year that you're applying, because it's like, who are you? Because the average U.S. medical student has made at least 2 to 3 interactions with attendings and residency directors, because they get to do sub-I's and they get to do, those are sub-internships, and they get to do all these internships within the program. So sometimes when you're applying, you realize, wow, these other people really knew the residents and they knew the attendings. So a year before, 2 years before, I made sure I did that. I went to Grand Rounds. I found out, and these are things that you can Google. You choose your favorite residency programs or the residency programs that you see you have the highest chances of getting in, residency programs that your medical students, the school that you went to, that those schools that accepted them in the residency programs, and then also residency programs that are IMG friendly, and then also ones that are new programs. Those are also very good programs that you should look at. So I did that, and I even researched programs that were just beginning, because those are also very good programs that you should do too. So I did that. I sent out cold emails, and I sent them out to the secretary of the residency program, asking them when they had grand rounds, and I would visit. And I did that for pretty much, I think I did it maybe once a month or once every other month for a whole year before I applied. So by the time I applied, I knew personally I could not apply to 30 schools, because that was too big of a net for me to put out there. I really could only apply to the schools that I really knew, that I kind of made a connection. I talked to the residents, I talked to the director. So for me, it was pretty much like 6 to 7 schools. The majority of them were in California, and then there was 2 in other states. And I made sure that I was able, when I was able to turn in my application, I even sent an email prior to the my contact that was in the school, letting them know, said, hey, I'm turning the application in, and I made sure that my application was complete. That's another thing. You don't really want to apply if you have kind of exams that are kind of hanging around, that you're waiting for an exam score. You really want to be ready when ERAS is open, when the token is open to do it. So I did that, and I knew pretty fast I was going to get a interview. So it was as soon as you get an interview and as soon as you have that dinner or wherever you have any social interaction, that's when you really are bidding for your seat. And so I think for me, that was another thing that I was really lucky that I was able to do to secure that. So when it came down to the rank list order, it was just pretty much where I felt like I had the strongest chance, where I had the most communication with the program director and the residents, and where I felt most comfortable. And so by match day, I knew that I was going to be matched where I wanted to be. And I'll tell you, I mean, it kind of sounds, you know, like miraculous, but I went through a lot. I mean, from failing step one, you know, not having any exams I remember doing USMLE World on tutor mode the whole time. Because I was just like, I have no idea. But for me, that was my issue. I needed to look at the answers that were wrong and learn from those answers. And I just did that. And until I could just turn it and take the timing off of it and just push through it. But I say, if I can do it, anybody can do it. And I still have Spanish in my head and I can still do it. So I think everybody can do this if you put your mind to it.
Yeah, I agree. I agree with you. A lot of our problems really start with our mindset, right? Like if we change our mindset, our approach, then sometimes it makes our problems easier to tackle because we can actually be clear-minded to figure out a solution, right? Like
absolutely.
Like when you're studying and you figure out, okay, this style of studying is not working, I need to switch it up. That is a mindset shift because it takes a lot for you to say, I'm going to quit doing it this way and do it this way. And do it again the same way the next day and the day after. So I really appreciate you bringing that point up. So you did touch on, you know, how you networked. It sounds like, you know, networking through specialty conferences, but you were also very strategic, very focused in where you wanted to go. And so you really kept it local, close to family. I think that's a point that anybody listening can also take home is, strategy is everything. If you know that you have something on your application that could be looked or frowned upon by a program or make you seem any way less appealing for whatever reason, whether it's true or untrue, I want you to really consider your strategy and how you can, you know, revert that a little bit or how you can learn from experiences like Dr. Sapoma's experience and say, hey, Let me reanalyze what's going on here and see if there's any room to pivot or any room to change something. I think her strategy of networking was intense. I mean, it sounds like you were contacting hospitals, contacting coordinators for grad, contacting conferences. And I really like that you touched on the relationship piece because networking, I think sometimes when we say network to an IMG, you may just feel like go to one conference and you're done.
No,
a lot of connections at one conference, but with every relationship, there needs to be some nurturing. There needs to be a give and take. So you need to be in these environments in a way that people know who you are. And your give may not be anything. It doesn't have to be like super great. Your give could be your poster or your presentation or your questions. The fact that you're engaged in conversation. It does not have to be super like something, you know, sometimes I feel like we have to like just, I don't know, knock some socks off or something before we'll get someone to talk to us.
You're so right. And let me tell you, I went to a residency program where there wasn't many IMGs. There was actually more U.S. students. And there was a lot of U.S. students that did sub-I. When I tell you, sitting, you know, in my third year as a senior resident and kind of hearing U.S. medical students present, I remember thinking when I was, you know, when I was a medical student, IMG applying to residency, that these U.S. students were perfect, and they, you know, that they just kind of knew how to present and kind of, you know, flew off of them, and it was so easy for them. But they really go through it as well, and so, and even with answering questions. So I think that if we all understand that by the time everybody gets to intern year, everybody, when you start residency, there's pretty much like a clean slate. Like you're really all trying to learn a process that is very new. So when you go into that, really understanding that there really isn't a dumb question. And if anybody tells you that, I mean, there really isn't. Engagement is the best question you can do, meaning that you are engaged, you're asking a question, you're even asking to repeat the question if you didn't understand it. If you're asking for clarification of a question, that's even better, because the person that proposed the question, it will give them an opportunity to even go in depth with the question. So I say, self-esteem with us IMGs, we really need to think about it. And we are very smart. We went to schools in other countries. We had to learn another environment, another way of eating, thinking, all types of things, and then return and then coming back to another country. So take that with you and really understand that that makes you mature already. So really kind of put that into your application and in your networking.
Yeah, I agree. And because, you know, learners are going to be learners, right? Whether it's a learner from a university in the States or a learner from a university in Cuba. And I think yes. That's something that we forget is we think that our counterparts that are in school here magically have it way better. Yes, well, they may have the priority for residency spots in some instances,
yes.
But they're just as much of a learner as we are. And so I just remember medicine is the same across the world. You know, the same struggles that you have learning anatomy in anywhere is the same struggle that, you know, a U.S. grad is going to have. And so it's important to not look for ways for us to differentiate ourselves from them, because that only adds our imposter syndrome or adds our struggle with assimilating to whatever
exactly.
style that exists. I think the biggest difference is the examination style. That's what I've noticed.
Yeah.
It's really a matter of understanding how to take a standardized test, period. And a standardized test in the US. Like, that's really the big deal. Because the material is the same. Because I actually, one of my professors in med school was training in Cuba, and I met doctors from all over the world that are very brilliant, and they have the same knowledge base. It's just when you come into a new system, there are system-based things that influence the way healthcare is run. The testing system is different, and those things sometimes require time to kind of figure out your style of learning them. But it's important that we remember that we're all in this together. We're all in this as students, or if you're listening and you're already a graduate, the message we're sending out is you're not alone in feeling the way that you do. And we're just trying to help to say, feel that way too. But you can make it on the other side if you remember that you're not the only one going through that and there is a way out.
Yes. And the other thing I'd like to say to the IMGs is that, you know, you are already preparing to be such an amazing doctor. You have studied in a country that is not the country where you will be practicing. So you will be used to meeting different types of patients and in living and understanding different situations. That is the best preparation that you will need to go into residency and then later to become a physician and an attending. So I think that you should give yourself credit for that, because for some students, they've been in the same town, the same area, and for the whole time. And the first time they ever have adversity is their first day of intern year.
Yeah.
So, you know, I really always try to applaud and remind IMGs that, you know, we really have come so far a long way.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. And we really appreciate having you on the show and giving us some insight into your pathway and how you've made it to the other side. So can you tell us where you practice, what you practice, what's your love, your clinical love right now?
Yeah, so my clinical love is I absolutely love teens. I'm doing a lot of work with doing healthcare, reproductive healthcare with teens, women's health. The cool thing about my practice right now is that I'm independent. So I'm an independent medical physician, meaning that I work per diem and I also work locums, and I'm also an independent medical evaluator. So I'm the one that if somebody's having an issue or they're trying to get disability or they're trying to figure out or second opinion, they can come to see me. And then I do my couple of days a week at my local community clinic. And I really love that as well. And I'm also a medical director for a nonprofit called the Birthing Project USA. So I really think that And, you know, just a little plug for family medicine. I know everybody's doing their different residencies or different specialties, but that's why I chose family medicine, so because I could do different things like that. And I am in San Diego, California, and you can find out about all the different things that I do. You go to my Instagram or even my Facebook or YouTube at Dr. Sarpoma, and it's just the way you spell, you say my name, it's just Dr. Sarpoma. You might see me singing and dancing, so be careful.
That's awesome. We like happy doctors. So we'll have all your Instagram handles and your social media handles in the show notes. I also have it spelled out in the show notes at Dr. Sarpoma, so you can just click on it and head over to her profile and give her a follow and connect with her. I know so many IMGs end up having questions after they listen to the episode. Are you open to them reaching out?
Absolutely. Yeah, I have a couple already that we've reached out, so that is completely fine.
Okay. Awesome.
I just might not be able to get back like at that second, but I definitely do. I reach back.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. So before we let you go, can you tell us your mantra for success?
Oh, yes. My mantra is, wherever you go, there you are. And it's pretty much a mindfulness-based mantra, pretty much telling you that you really can't go too far from yourself, and nothing can, wherever you travel, wherever you go to a new job, new relationship, that you really should find foundation in what you love and what really your passion. So that's my mantra. Wherever you go, you are there.
I love it. I love it. I love it. I'm all about mindfulness and being present. So I definitely love
Yes.
All right. Thank you so much for joining us on the IMG Roadmap podcast. We look forward
to
growing this relationship with you and connecting with you and asking you more questions. So
be on the lookout
for all our emails and DMs and PMs and everything else.
No problem. And I get them in Espanol also, so it's fine.